In this second hour of the program today, we'll go to the Focus 580 archives for a show that we first presented in July. As you listen, do keep in mind that in this hour of the show, we will not take your calls. These days, there are a lot of people here in the United States who are very concerned about the high cost of prescription drugs. If people are taking multiple medications, their monthly bills can be very, very high. And one of the ways that people are trying to cope with that is buying their medicine in other countries, in Canada, in Ireland, over the internet, wherever they can get it. Now, people in the federal government have looked at that trend, and they are concerned, and they have warned that one potential problem might be that people will buy prescription medication and not really know what it is they're getting, opening themselves up to the possibility that they might buy a counterfeit medicine. Our guest this morning, investigative medical reporter Catherine Eben, says it's even worse than that because there have been cases and there is a possibility that someone here in the United States could go to their local pharmacy, wherever they have their prescriptions filled, possibly have a medication dispensed by a hospital or by a nursing home, and still get a counterfeit medication. We're talking this morning about what you will find in her book, Dangerous Doses, How Counterfeiters Are Contaminating America's Drug Supply. That's the subtitle. It's published by Harcourt, and this is a story that she has been working on for some time now. She has worked for a variety of publications, including the New York Times, the New York Observer, and ABC News. She's also contributed articles to The Nation, The New Republic, The New Yorker, Self, Vogue, and Glamour. And if you're interested in reading the book, you can go out to the bookstore and look for it. Ms. Eben, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Fine. Great to be here.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. This is something that I'm sure is difficult to kind of get a hold on for a variety of reasons. An awful lot of prescriptions are filled in this country every year, and sometimes there are bad outcomes. People take a medication prescribed by their doctors. It is an appropriate medication. There are bad outcomes. You just never know exactly what's going to happen. There are no guarantees in medicine. And so if you ask this question, well, out of all of the prescriptions that are filled in this country every year, how many do you think, in how many cases, are people getting a counterfeit medicine? Can you even put a number on that?
Well, the FDA put a number on it. It was a back-of-the-envelope estimate. They said about 1% of the nation's drug supply is counterfeit. Now, that sounds reassuringly small, but you've got to consider 1% is 35 million prescriptions a year. And the medicine that has been targeted by domestic counterfeiters is the most expensive medicine, generally, for the sickest patients who need it the most. So that's cancer medicine, AIDS medicine, and it's for the kind of patients who can least afford to negotiate a counterfeit.
Yeah. Well, there just, again, you point at something that I'm sure, again, makes it difficult to get a hold of the story. If we're talking about medications that are going to the sickest people, these are the people whose prognosis probably is not going to be very good. So if someone has one of those conditions and they're taking medication and they die, how does one know, well, is it the medicine? Did they get bad medicine? Or is it, sadly, they just died from the condition that they had?
Well, this is exactly why investigators call it the perfect crime, because who's to know whatever killed these patients? Now, I spent 3 years following around a group of investigators in Florida who called themselves the Horsemen of the Apocalypse, who saw themselves as on a biblical crusade to stop bad medicine, counterfeit medicine, from reaching patients. And they would have loved to charge the counterfeiters, some of whom they did catch, with murder. But again, how do you link an outcome for a patient to the counterfeit medicine they took?
Mm-hmm. How do we, for in those instances where we do discover that someone has taken a counterfeit medication, how do we discover that? I mean, how is that? Is it that the person has ill effects, or that's there is some other way? Ultimately do we find out?
Well, it really depends on both the nature of the counterfeit as well as the reaction of the patient. But just to give you a couple of examples, I follow the story of a 16-year-old Long Island boy named Timothy Fagan who underwent a liver transplant. And His doctor afterward prescribed Epogen for anemia. He was very weak. His mom figured they'd survived the liver transplant. Now she was going to save his life with this very expensive injectable medicine and gave it to him once a week. And he began suffering these horrible convulsions after each injection. He was on a number of different medications, so it was hard exactly to tell what was causing it. But he also wasn't getting any better. And then, after about 8 weeks of these injections, the manufacturer of the drug released a counterfeit warning that there were counterfeits in the marketplace. That's how the family put two and two together, but it was a horrible realization for the Fagans that they had been injecting their son for eight straight weeks with medicine they thought was saving him but was possibly killing him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose that gets at the issue that anytime people take medication, there can be side effects, and that people sometimes don't know what's really going on. And they might ask themselves, well, is this just part of the a side effect that maybe it's not pleasant for me, but it's not life-threatening, goes with the medicine? Do I call my doctor? Do I talk to my pharmacist? What in this situation exactly do I do? And I suppose it might depend on what the severity of the symptoms there or the reaction you think you're having might be.
Well, you know, before I started reporting the book, of course, we all know people who have been patients and suddenly their medicine just stops working. So the doctor has to increase the dose or they have to switch to another medication. You know, and I never would have thought twice about that until I entered this pharmaceutical underworld, which exists between the manufacturer's loading docks and the drugstore.
Hmm. There are a lot of things we could talk about here, but let me ask you one other question, and then I have a caller, and I think we'll get to them rather than make them wait a whole lot longer. I think you make the argument in the book that this is a problem that has been growing for some time. It's something that government regulators and some people in law enforcement and so forth are aware of, and I'm sure people in the medical community are aware of it, but that it's not something that it has a high level of public awareness. And the question is, why do you think that it is the case that we have not, in the media, we haven't seen more stories about this?
Well, first of all, drug makers historically have done their best to bury these cases from public view. They have settled lawsuits confidentially. They have effectively supported what has been a big diversion market in pharmaceuticals. And by that, I mean this all-hours auction, this trading of expensive pharmaceuticals back and forth between middlemen, wholesalers, distributors, repackagers. But what happened was, around the year 2000, a little bit earlier, this diversion market began to get much worse because narcotics traffickers, who were fleeing all the criminal penalties of the drug war, started looking around for a new line of work. And what they discovered was this largely unregulated hinterland of our pharmaceutical supply chain, where the regulation, believe it or not, is minimal. The criminal penalties are almost non-existent, and the returns are astronomical. And those are the guys who introduced counterfeits into what was already a very dangerous arbitrage game with our medicine.
Well, we can talk more about that as we continue our conversation. I do have a caller we'll get right to. Let me just also quickly introduce again our guest. We're talking with Catherine Eben. She's an investigative medical reporter, and this is a story that she has been following and working on for some time now. She's contributed pieces to various publications on this issue and others. And if you're interested in reading in depth on this particular subject, that is the problem of counterfeit prescription medications, she's authored a book, and it's titled Dangerous Doses. It's published by Harcourt and should be out available in the bookstore. Questions, too, are welcome here on the program. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here listening this morning over in Indiana. We'll go right there. Line 4. Hello.
Hello. Very germane discussion considering the health situation in this country in terms of the government helping things. My general question is transparency. You mentioned already that it starts right at the back of the dock, And since you've mentioned the word counterfeit, I presume that the medicines have the same markings on them. And if a pharmacist picked one up and looked at it, and from his experience, he would know that that's, for example, Topro without any problem. There wouldn't be any reason for him to think that it was other than if he looked at the packages that come into the pharmacy, they should have certain writings on them, things like that. I'm just sort of hoping that you'll talk about that sort of thing. In some sense, relying on the pharmaceutical companies is almost disingenuous because they don't seem to respond to public demands one way or the other. That's all I wanted to say. Thanks a lot.
Okay, well, thanks for the question. Well, obviously, the caller raises several questions, and we want to talk about all of this. Maybe let me just pick one to start with, and that is the question he raised about how easy it is to spot whether something is counterfeit or genuine.
It's very difficult. The counterfeiters are very sophisticated, and, you know, the printing technology is so ubiquitous that even the packaging specialists at the drug companies can barely tell the difference between the fake and the real. Now, you can notice sometimes in pills it tastes a little different. There were just tiny distinguishing marks on some of the labels, and it is important for patients to scrutinize their medicine. I have safety tips both in my book and on my website, which is dangerousdoses.com. And patients should always take their pills in the light, put them in their hands first, see if they look any different. It was interesting, there was recently a counterfeiting episode in Canada, of all places, where a pharmacy was dispensing counterfeit Norvasc, which is for heart patients. And in that case, the usually white pills were slightly gray, so they were bad counterfeits. Easy for a patient to detect. But in the counterfeiting incidents here, it has been very difficult.
Well, let's go to and I'll ask you to talk a little bit about how distribution works, because I think, as you point out, that people probably, to the extent that they think about it at all, think, well, it works like this. You have a manufacturer that makes the product. They sell that product to a wholesaler, and then the wholesaler distributes the product to local pharmacies, to hospitals, to nursing homes, to all of the end-of-the-line providers. Those are the ones that then, the prescription comes in, they get the prescription, they give the medicine to the individual. That's what people think is going on. But in fact, one of the things that you point out is within the wholesale world, the middleman part of this, it's not. There are some big major wholesalers, but in fact, there are an awful lot of small ones, and there's a lot of trading back and forth, of passing medication back and forth, perhaps legitimately, but that creates the conditions that make it possible for counterfeits to get into the system.
That's absolutely right. In an ideal world, you've described the distribution system from manufacturer to wholesaler to pharmacy, making one stop between the manufacturer and the pharmacy. Let me tell you what I uncovered in the case of Timothy Fagan. There was a tiny little pharmacy in South Florida, in Miami, that was ordering huge amounts of low-dose Epogen from big national wholesalers, Cardinal and AmerisourceBergen. So now, in an ideal world, that pharmacy would have dispensed all those vials of low-dose Epogen to patients, but they didn't dispense it to a single patient. Instead, what they did is they sold it out the back door to just an unlicensed guy, a middleman in Florida, who then sold it to a counterfeiter who had high-dose labels, 40,000 UML, printed up. And so he soaked the vials overnight, removed the low dose labels, and glued on the high dose ones, increasing the value of about 110,000 vials of this medicine by $46 million.
Mm-hmm.
In turn, he sold it to some buyers who were guys who operated a strip club in South Miami. They sold it to some narcotics traffickers who owned shell companies. These were licensed companies through the state of Florida that were supposed to be wholesalers but weren't really. They sold it to others who sold it to others. Finally, it ends up getting sold to a quasi-legitimate wholesaler who resells the drugs to AmerisourceBergen, the big wholesaler that sold the low dose in the first place. This time, they buy the drugs for a discount because they think they're getting a discount on the high-dose Epogen. The drugs moved all the way around the distribution system through about a dozen hands, and Amerisource distributed this to CVS Pharmacy. I mean, it's a mind-boggling chain, and I know it sounds incredibly confusing when I describe it, but it's anything but a straight passage of the drugs. It's everyone in the middle arbitraging the price of the drugs, buying low, selling high. A counterfeiter sits somewhere in the chain, up-labels the drugs. The people who buy it think they're getting a discount on the high dose, and it ends up being distributed to Timothy Fagan in Long Island, who's just recovering from a liver transplant.
So when I'm sure that I would imagine, again, when people think about the when you say counterfeit drugs, they might think that, well, what we're talking about here is something that is labeled as a particular medicine and that it's nothing of the sort. It could be, I suppose it could be anything else. It could be an aspirin labeled as something else. It could it could be water. It could be just a bottle of water. So
that
would be one thing. But then there also is the case where there is adulteration. So you might take a genuine medicine and cut it so that you would be able to get more, or in this particular case, take a genuine medicine that is a particular dosage and change the label. So the person is getting, it is the medication that they think that they're getting, but not the dosage that they think that they're getting. So they in fact are ending up taking less than they think they are and that they are supposed to be. So it sounds like there are a variety of ways that this can happen. I don't know if any one of these particular is more likely than any other.
There have been a whole array of schemes, but basically the definition of a counterfeit is that what is on the label does not match what is in the bottle or in the vial. So in that case, the up-labeled Epogen is a counterfeit, but there are a lot of drugs as they move through this system. They're not counterfeit per se, but they are adulterated. And what that means is that their origin is unknown, and as a result, they are not fit for human consumption because we don't know where they came from. And if we don't know where they came from, we can't vouch for what's in them.
I'm sure as people listen to the example that you gave and think about all these individuals who are passing these medications from hand to hand, people who are various kinds of shady operators, people who are involved in organized crime, and, you know, who knows what, and perhaps also legitimate drug wholesalers. The question they'll have is, well, what do you have to do, who do you have to be able to be a drug wholesaler? Is there no kind of licensing or inspection or regulation of drug wholesalers?
Well, this is really incredible. Let me take Florida for an example, and a lot of the story of dangerous doses is set there. Basically, you just needed to have a pulse to be able to get a state license. The statewide Bureau of Pharmaceutical Services gave you an application form, and it had a question on it: are you a convicted felon? And guess what? All the felons checked the no box. There were no criminal background checks. You had to put down $700, prove that you had a refrigerator, air conditioning, and a lock on the door, and you were in business. And as a result, the state ended up giving legitimate licenses to convicted narcotics traffickers.
Given the fact that there is perhaps some growing, it may be small and it may be slow, but growing awareness of this issue, are there places where state regulators are starting to talk about, maybe this is something that would happen at the level of, I don't know, of the state government or of the state legislature or whatever, are talking about tightening the rules about who can be a drug wholesaler?
Yes, that's the good news. Nevada, Florida actually changed its laws. California, New Jersey looks to be heading that way. You know, but the problem is these investigators, the horsemen of the apocalypse in Florida, say they end up just exporting crime, because if you close loopholes in one state, the bad guys just move to another state. And so what you need, what we really need, is federal regulation of this. And so far, your listeners may not be surprised, there has not been any.
Has there even been discussion?
Well, there has been discussion, and in fact, there was a law passed in 1988 which would have required a comprehensive pedigree trail or audit trail for every drug as it passed through the distribution system. But lobbyists for the wholesalers stepped in and gutted that legislation. They made the argument to those in power that this was too difficult, too costly, too burdensome to have to document the path of the drugs. And that is why now when a drug arrives at our pharmacy, nobody can tell you where it's been. And it took me 3 years of investigation with the help of the Horsemen of the Apocalypse and many other sources to figure out where Timothy Fagan's medicine had been. And, of course, as it turned out, it had been sitting in a beer cooler in the back of a strip club in South Florida.
Yeah. One of the parties that I would expect would be very concerned about this, because it would ultimately and would involve their good name, would be the drug manufacturers, the people who make the medications in the first place. Is that something that concerns them? And is there something at the production end that they could do to try to minimize the possibility of counterfeiting?
Yes, and they are doing it. They have become very sophisticated about security and packaging of the drugs. So they have introduced all kinds of both overt and covert elements into the packaging. There are holograms. There is color-changing ink, which is the kind used in the new $20 bills. There are even chemical tags or markers that are embedded both in the packaging and in the medicine itself. But they acknowledge that given 12 to 18 months, counterfeiters can copy anything. They have replicated holograms. So you have to continually shift the security markers on this packaging. It's very complicated to do.
We're at our midpoint here in this hour of Focus 580. Let me introduce again our guests. Catherine Eben is an investigative medical reporter. She's worked for The New York Times, The New York Observer, ABC News. She's also contributed articles to a number of different publications, including The Nation, The New Republic, The New Yorker, Self, Vogue, Glamour. She's the author of a book that deals with the subject here we're talking about in depth, the result of several years' worth of reporting on the subject. The title of her book is Dangerous Doses, How Counterfeiters Are Contaminating America's Drug Supply. That's the subtitle. It's published by Harcourt. Is in the bookstore if you want to read it. And questions here on the program are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You mentioned that that there are various states in their regulatory apparatus that are paying attention to it and are trying to tighten their laws that govern who can be a drug wholesaler, but that your argument is and it's understandable that simply creates a magnet for those places that have the weak regulation. If you're in a state, they tighten the rules on you, you can just go someplace else. And for that reason, the real way of getting at the problem would be to have a national system of regulation. We do have a national agency that is supposed to oversee the safety and efficacy of the drug supply, and that's the Food and Drug Administration. How are they addressing the problem, or is FDA trying to address the problem?
Well, remarkably, the FDA says it does not regulate the supply chain. It regulates what happens in the manufacturer's laboratories to make sure the drugs are made safely. But as soon as they leave the loading docks, it's up to the states. That's what they say. So effectively, our drugs are just falling into this black hole. And that's why it really is like the Wild West out there. I mean, I have sat down with licensed drug wholesalers who have long felony records, heroin addictions, who can't even read and write, and these are people who are distributing millions of dollars of our cancer medicine. You know, the FDA is now disseminating just proposed voluntary guidelines for industry. They're pushing industry towards something that's called RFID, which is radio frequency identification, which is like little barcodes with antenna so you can track drugs through the distribution system. And it's all very interesting, and it's all very James Bond. But the fact of the matter is that the immediate solutions that we need are really old-fashioned ones. We need paper records of where these drugs have been. We need much stronger criminal penalties to lock up these bad guys, you know, and you've got pockets of very dedicated state investigators, the one group, the horsemen, whose story I tell, who are banging their head against the wall and working 18 hours a day to try to stem this tide of bad medicine with absolutely no help from federal regulators.
Let's talk about the issue of penalties for a bit, because you have talked about the fact that some of the people who've gotten into this business of peddling counterfeit medication are criminals who previously had been involved with illegal drugs, and that they made the switch because if you get arrested for distributing counterfeit prescription medicine, the penalties are much less severe than if you were arrested for selling, say, heroin or cocaine or something like that. What sort of penalties are there for people who are caught doing this?
Well, in large part, they've just been misdemeanors and penalties for counterfeiters misbranding a commercial product, for example. So, you know, you're looking at a couple years in jail or nominal fines. And the only way to successfully prosecute, and some states have done it, and the horsemen managed to do it, is with racketeering cases. You know, you go after these guys the way the feds went after the mob. And you identify the conspiracy that it is with all of the predicate crimes, wire fraud, money laundering, kickbacks, all those sorts of things which are going on in this corrupt universe. But those are very, very difficult cases to make, and you have to get a really dedicated group of law enforcement together to bring those cases.
I suppose the extreme would be that if you had someone and you could establish that they had knowingly put a counterfeit prescription medication into the system and that it ended up with a patient and that patient took it and that patient died, you could charge that person, the one who was responsible, with some variety of murder. I guess that would be the ultimate. Has any case like that ever come to trial or come anywhere close to going to trial?
No, not criminally. Hmm. You know, take the case of a guy named Eddie Gorin in Miami who decided that he was going to take Procrit vials, and Procrit is for cancer, and just fill them with Miami tap water, which has E. coli in it. I mean, any patient with a compromised immune system who's injecting this stuff is going to die. The argument of one of his associates, who was captured on an undercover wire, was they're going to die anyway because they're so sick, so it's okay to do it. Anyway, Gorin was caught. He was sentenced to three years in prison, and he didn't serve all of it. That's the problem.
Hmm. Well, again, I want to make sure that people who are listening know that we're open to questions as we continue to talk with our guest, Catherine Eben. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana. If you'd happen to be listening over the Internet as we are webcasting, you can use that number, too, as long as you're in the United States. That is 800-222-9455. So that's the toll-free, and the local number is 333-9455. At any point here, you have questions, you can give us a call. I want to give you the opportunity maybe to talk a little bit more about, you mentioned the fact that you had concentrated a lot of your reporting on the state of Florida, and that you had spent some time following this particular group of investigators, state-level investigators, who were trying to work on that problem there in Florida. Who, in under under what branch of or what Department of State government does this happen? Who on the state level is really responsible?
Well, it's interesting how this group came together. There are two pharmacists from the Bureau of Statewide Pharmaceutical Services, one special agent from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, and two Miami-Dade cops. The two pharmacists had been warning law enforcement for years that they had seen this gray market in action. Criminals buying and selling cancer medicine in parking lots, ferrying around Procrit vials in their steaming car trunks when this is medicine that needs to be preserved perfectly and kept cold. No one paid attention to them. And then one day, they walked into the office of a 28-year-old prosecutor named Stephanie Feldman, who stands about 5 feet tall. They explained what they had been seeing, and she said, "Let's do this case." And the reason she understood it is because she was an insulin-dependent diabetic who had to inject herself 5 times a day. She knows that if the medicine isn't preserved exactly in the right way, delivered to patients at the right time, that their lives are threatened. She called this task force Operation Stone Cold because she saw the people who were doing this as stone cold killers. And it brought together this band of investigators. They were all over 50. One of them was 72 years old with 2 hearing aids. They really had not had a day of luck in their lives. And finally, this was the case of a lifetime. And it was the relationship of these 5 men that led me to write the book because of how much they cared about this and how many obstacles they faced. So Dangerous Doses is really their story of their investigation as well as my own investigation nationally of what had happened. But that's the kind of commitment that you need in order to bring these cases, and that's why it's happened so rarely.
Let's talk with somebody else here. We're getting some other callers. We have someone listening in Bloomington, Illinois, not too far away, on the toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for your show. I enjoy it. I listen as often as I can.
Great.
I appreciate it. And I did tune in late today, so I'm not real clear that, but the I heard you describe the trail of this one drug through one entity after another. At what point, I really have two questions, at what point did you, was this discovered that it was a problem? And then my other question was, I wondered, you know, what can we as citizens do, just ordinary citizens?
Right. Well, you know, unfortunately, the counterfeits that were created, the counterfeit Epogen, was only discovered after it had already reached patients.
Mm.
Now, there were 110, we know who, I identified that you'll meet the counterfeiter in my book. I won't tell you his name because it'll give it away, but you will meet him.
Mm-hmm.
He counterfeited 110,000 vials of this medicine. Investigators, the horsemen who I describe, were desperate to recover this medicine, as were some federal agents. Together, they were only able to track down 13,000 vials, which means that 97,000 other vials were released into the supply chain and are presumed to have reached patients.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's enough medicine to treat some 30,000 cancer patients for a month.
Gosh, it's awful.
So that gives you a sense of, you know, both the scope and the problem. Now, what can you do? I want to remind listeners, on my website, dangerousdoses.com, I have a list of safety tips and things you can look for to help identify your medicine. And obviously, as consumers, we should reward pharmacies and other people who declare that they're only going to buy, you know, direct, that they're not going to purchase from wholesalers who buy from this secondary market of shady wholesalers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, try to put pressure on our pharmacies and educate our pharmacists about this problem.
Yeah. At what point did was this drug discovered to be counterfeit? At what point? How was it discovered? Or
Well, I mean, it was discovered in part because patients were calling the manufacturer to complain that they were having strange side effects or that their medicine wasn't working.
I see.
That's part of the way that it got discovered.
I see. Can we trust reputable pharmacies such as Walgreens to purchase
properly? The short answer is no, because, they are purchasing from wholesalers who are purchasing from secondary wholesalers.
Yeah.
These shady operations.
Uh-huh.
Walgreens, Duane Reade, Rite Aid, Eckerd's, CVS, I mean, they've all had problems with this.
Uh-huh.
So that is what the book is about. It is not about internet medicine. It is not about, medicine we're buying across the border. It is about the medicine that we trust the most and pay more for than anyone in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for all your work.
All right.
You're welcome.
Well, thanks for the call. And what really makes this, it gives one pause is we were talking earlier about the fact that some of the medicines that have been counterfeited are things that are very, very expensive. And that's understandable from from the profit motive, because if you're going to counterfeit something, you'd want it to be an item that is very expensive. But when you take a look also on your website, when you take a look at some of the particular medicines that have been counterfeited, some of these are common and are not anything particularly exotic, including things like penicillin and Cipro and Vioxx and Zocor and Zyprexa. These are things that there are an awful lot of people in this country that are taking.
Well, that's actually the other profit motive. You've just named it.
Oh, it's volume, 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 right?
That's right. So it's either phenomenally high cost or big volume sellers.
Yeah.
The counterfeiters, there was a huge counterfeit incident with Lipitor, which is the nation's number one selling drug for high cholesterol. And 18 million doses of Lipitor had to be recalled because of the counterfeiting threat. Now, I think that our elected officials ignored this problem for a long time, except when they counterfeited Lipitor, then everybody in the U.S. Congress, most of whom take it, started saying, well, we have a real problem on our hands here.
We have other callers here. We'll go to caller here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I had two questions. Well, one picks up on what you were talking about just now about the pharmacies. Doesn't matter if they're, a large or well-known pharmacy chain or whatever. I understood that that CVS was at least claiming to only buy the prescription drugs from anyone who doesn't deal directly with the manufacturer, but you think that's, am I right to think that you think that's not enough?
Well, that is correct. I mean, CVS did recently make an announcement that it was only going to buy from wholesalers who bought directly from manufacturers. It sounds very good. It's the right direction. The problem is that really none of the big wholesalers have stopped buying from the secondary market. Now, Cardinal Health, which is one of the nation's three largest wholesalers, made an announcement that they were going to close their trading division. And the trading division was the division that bought discounted drugs from the secondary market. But in fact, they have not pulled out of purchasing from the secondary market entirely. There's a lot of, beneath the sort of public relations declarations, there is a lot of fine print that still needs to be understood.
Yeah, this whole secondary market thing, it goes completely contrary to what I understood the pharmacy's principles were, in that When they argue against reimportation of drugs, they like to say that I've heard it argued that they don't want drugs coming in from Canada because they sell the drugs cheaper to Canada because Canada has a it doesn't have our standard of living and therefore can't really afford it at our price, and that Congress is going to help them, and by making it illegal for people to resell. And the whole idea is that they will therefore recover their investment in R&D, you know.
Right. Well.
And so how is it that now when apparently the industry stands to profit, it's okay to have arbitrage and
mm-hmm.
you know, all this reselling?
Oh well, you've really put your finger on it. It's a tremendous irony. The drug makers say, well, you know, if we bring in drugs from abroad, we'll be contaminating our otherwise pure supply. But in fact, our supply is not pure. The drug makers know this. I mean, we have some of the best criminals in the world, and that's what fascinated me about this story is, you know, everybody thinks, oh, counterfeit medicine. We're talking about, you know, Mexico, India, China. No, actually, we're talking about, you know, Miami, New York, you know. It's going on here. The problem is within our borders. So then when you consider that we're going to these pharmacies, we're paying more for our medicine than anybody in the world, and we still may not be getting pure stuff, that's incredible.
Thanks.
All right. Let's go to the next caller here. Maybe real quick, I will introduce again our guest first. We'll have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus. We're talking with Catherine Eben. She's an investigative medical reporter. She's worked for The New York Times, New York, New York Observer, ABC News, contributed articles to a number of different publications. If you want to read more on this subject, counterfeit prescription drugs, you look for her new book. It's titled Dangerous Doses. It's published by Harcourt. Next is a caller in Charleston, line number two. Hello.
Yes. It appears to me that your guest is enunciating the anomalies of private enterprise. And where you have private enterprise, you're going to have exactly what your guest is speaking of. I can hearken back to a book I read recently, The Trail of Tears, when government subsidies produce the products, we're going to move the Indians west, consisted of rotten meat and bad water. Entrepreneurs came along, exploited that market, and we're talking a long time ago. And now we're up to date and nothing has changed. I mean, this is the first I've heard of what your guest has had to say about prescription drugs. But is anyone surprised that this stuff goes on? And she just said that we have some of the best criminals in the world. and I think that's reasonable because where is the most exploitable market in the world other than the U.S. because we have more money? Then you have these criminals and subhuman types who come along and then exploit the victim, just like the Harp brothers down at Cave-In Rock. So, I mean, nothing has changed and nothing is going to change until we get some handle on how to organize our society without the opportunist who can come along and then exploit people. Do you have anything?
I think you're raising a terrific point. You know, one question here is, well, you know, should anything be outside of this arbitrage system? You know, and of course, like, the dirty word is price regulation. But, you know, maybe our life-saving pharmaceuticals should not be traded like pork bellies. It's just something to think about.
Yes, well, capitalism is what it is, and it's never going to change until some revolutionary activity begins that can overthrow that paradigm and set up a new system whereby the criminal has no motive to go and exploit and to kill people and be the pirate society that we live in. We live in a piratical society, there is no question, from top to bottom. And have you ever heard the story of the Harp brothers in Cave-In Rock?
I had not.
They watched down there, had a lookout, flatboat coming up the river in pioneer times. We're talking 1820s. And they would holler down the flatboat, and then they get their craft ready. They paddle out, intercept the boat, kill all of the passengers on the boat, gut them, fill their bodies with rocks, throw them in a river, take the flatboat and all right on down to New Orleans and turn the material and then come back and do that over and over again.
Mm.
For 30 years that went on.
Mm.
And then somehow that a system with a history like that is going to be fixed by laws or by policing and all that, when the police will turn criminal too whenever the price is right. So what I'm saying is that we must change the paradigm, and unless we do, then we're thank goodness for folk like yourself who can point these things out, but will it institute change? Can it institute change? No, I think not.
Hmm.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Well, assuming that we don't have a revolution anytime soon and that the prescription drug industry does not decide to convert itself into a nonprofit, short of those two things, what can be done? What do you think reasonably can be done? And you do make some suggestions about what consumers can do to try to watch out for themselves. But we can again touch on that. But I guess I'm particularly thinking on the governmental regulatory side.
Yeah. First of all, I am a big believer in laws. I think they do really help. The day that my book was published, Congressman Steve Israel of Long Island, who represents the Fagan family. They're his constituents, held a press conference and announced a proposal, Tim Fagan's Law, which would close some of the loopholes in the drug supply. It would require much higher standards federally for wholesalers. It would require a comprehensive paper trail for every drug as it moved through the system, so there would be some way to find out or track back where it had been, increase criminal penalties for tampering with medicine, for falsifying pedigree papers. It would strengthen the enforcement arm of the Food and Drug Administration, the Office of Criminal Investigation there, which does great work, but they're woefully understaffed. So, this is a law that is really worth its salt. He's looking for a co-sponsor in the Senate now. Your viewers can see that law. It's on my website. There's a link to it, which is dangerousdoses.com. If you go there, you can see that law. So there is, there is a lot to be done, and there are, inklings that there is a response in the industry, though small, with Cardinal Health's announcement and CVS's announcement. Now, those are small. It's not comprehensive, but it's a start. I think if you get people at least saying the right things, it is maybe one step closer to doing the right thing.
The FDA does have a website. They do have information about prescription drugs there. Is there useful information there?
I think you're talking about the MedWatch site, and I have a link to that on my website as well. That's a place where patients can find alerts about counterfeits, and they can also enter in information if they suspect they've gotten counterfeits. So it's definitely not a tool to be ignored. It is useful. It's certainly not perfect, but it helps.
Hmm. And as far as individuals are concerned, the things that you suggest are, if, for example, you've been taking a medicine and you've been taking it for a long time, if you get a new prescription and something about it seems different, seems not right, or if you're taking it and you're having some sort of symptom or side effect that you never had before, or any kind of concern like that, you really need to follow up either with your doctor or with your pharmacist or probably both.
Both. Talk to your doctor and your pharmacist. And also, I would suggest calling the manufacturer. Most of those drug companies will have phone numbers on their websites where you can reach a human being and talk to them about it. But some of the drug makers will say, if you suspect you've gotten counterfeit medicine, send us back your medicine. Send us back all your medicine and we'll send you good stuff. Do not send back all your medicine. Keep some, because it is, if you got counterfeit, it's the only evidence you'll have that you did.
And I think, I should say I have no connection with the pharmacy industry, but that the people should realize that their pharmacist, the person who's there behind the counter who dispenses the medicine, is a good source of information.
And
whenever people have questions about what they're taking, what it's supposed to do, how they're supposed to take it, potential side effects, any and all that kind of stuff, they should not hesitate to discuss that with the pharmacist. And that, and if that person isn't interested in talking with them and answering their questions, then maybe they should think about going someplace else.
I agree completely. People should talk to their pharmacist, definitely. But a lot of pharmacists do not know about what is happening in the distribution system.
Hmm.
They don't know about the, you know, buying practices of the companies they work for, and some of them don't even know about this counterfeit problem. What makes me very pleased now as I go around the country and talk about this issue, I am beginning to address large groups of pharmacists. You know, I wish I could get my book into the hands of every single one of them because they need to know. So I think, you know, patients should try to educate their pharmacists. That's a very positive thing.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop. We have come to the end of the time. Again, if people are interested in reading the book, it's titled Dangerous Doses. It's published by Harcourt. You can look for it in the library. Also, there's information available on the website that our guest has mentioned, which is dangerousdoses.com. You can read more about the book, get some more information on the issue. Our guest, Catherine Eben, is investigative medical reporter. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.